Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Baleria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
It is my pleasure to introduce our Silicon Valley Reads author, Brian Copeland. Brian Copeland is well known to our Bay Area audiences as an actor, comedian, and broadcast personality on KGO Radio. In 2004, Brian debuted his one-man show, Not a Genuine Black Man, his personal story of feeling like an outsider growing up in San Leandro during the 1970s, when the city was 99.9% white and not very welcoming for any African-American family. The play was originally scheduled for a six-week run, but ran for over 2 years, becoming the longest-running solo in San Francisco history. He's performed it off-Broadway, in Los Angeles, as well as other Bay Area venues. Brian's book grew out of the show and has received critical acclaim. His inspirational story is currently being developed into a feature film and a television series. Moderating tonight's conversation, we are very fortunate to have with us this evening Mike Cassidy, columnist from the San Jose Mercury News. So now, ladies and gentlemen, you can clap. It's time to welcome Brian Copeland and Mike Cassidy.
It's a little like a ride at Disneyland.
Just... Okay. Good evening and good night.
Hi there.
These are great chairs. You're right. These are good chairs.
I like them very much.
There are complimentary gifts to take home, I'm told, which is wonderful.
Now, I was once told to never follow the jazz band, but here we are. I mean, that was something else. But actually, you know, it's always great to be in this beautiful old theater. And especially for this event, and especially tonight, because we're here with Brian Copeland, star of stage and screen and radio.
And Cars Wash While You Wait.
And he's an author, which is something I think is tremendous. I've always said that writing can be kind of a lonely performance. You sit alone and work and work and work, and there's no crowd like you guys cheering. And so I thought I'd start by congratulating Brian on an important and very moving book, and hope you'd join me in giving him a big hand for that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You know, Brian, before we get started, really started, I thought I'd address the elephant in the room, which is I'm not a genuine black man either. In fact, they pretty much got the whitest guy they could find to do this.
Except it's okay, they thought I might need to catch a cab afterwards and I could use your help, so that's good.
It could be something like that. But there is that white guy in the Mac and PC commercials. He might be a touch white. Or the guy I saw on YouTube introducing you at Google over the summer.
Oh, yes.
That guy
yes.
was white. But I can relate a little bit because I've been told I'm not a genuine Irish man. Don't go for the corned beef and cabbage. Took me a while to develop the taste for Guinness. But I am with you on the Jameson.
Okay, I was going to ask you about the Irish whiskey. Okay.
All the way. But seriously, we should probably get to work. And the one thing I was hoping you might start us out with, though the many here who've read the book are familiar with parts of this, but I'm curious about where the book came from. What compelled you to write this book?
I like to say that my entire career is a fluke, and basically that's kind of how this whole process began. It was, about 7 years ago, 8 years ago now, and I found myself a single dad with custody of three kids by myself, seventh grade, fifth grade, and first grade. See where I cut myself shaving? all by myself. And before that, I've been, you know, I've been traveling, opening for Smokey Robinson and, right. and Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and these kinds of folks. And suddenly, my life became about, you know, carpools and emergency forms and field trips and I was ready to climb up on a tower with a rifle, actually, at some point. And I knew I had to do something, but I didn't know what it was that I wanted to do at this point. So then 9/11 hits.
Yeah.
And when 9/11 hit, there were a lot of stories that. That really moved us, touched us, broke our hearts. But the one that really got to me was the story of Cantor Fitzgerald, the brokerage firm that was in, I can't remember which tower the firm was located in. And I'm watching CNN, and I see the president of this company on, and he was talking about how he was usually the first one at his desk every morning at 8 or 7 o'clock or whatever it is. And this particular morning, it was his son's first day at kindergarten, so he decided to take his son to school, so he wasn't there. But everybody else was. Yeah. So he lost something like 99% of, literally, like 99% of his employees he lost. And I remember before they went to a break, they showed a montage of people who'd been killed, of his employees. Right. And they were all shapes and sizes and ages and colors. And I thought about all these people who that morning had kissed their children or their husbands or wives or girlfriends or boyfriends and said, see you tonight. And this Saturday we're going to go canoeing. And next summer we're going to go to Europe. Right. And, you know, someday we're going to, you know, fly in an airplane and skydive. And someday... Yeah. And I realized that, you know, to be crass, you never really know when your plane is going to hit your tower and that it is someday. We all have things that we say that we're going to do someday. So what I did was is I made a list of all the things that I said. I called it my someday list, and which is funny is what it really was a bucket list, which
right.
is a, I ended up being in the picture when Rob Reiner did
right.
it. So it was just funny how things happen. And I called it my someday list of all the things I said I was going to do someday. So the first thing was to write a one-man stage show. Because after I started doing stand-up comedy the week after I graduated high school, wow. when I was 18 years old, and that's, you know, I've been performing live ever since. And the next natural evolution from stand-up is to do this kind of a performance where it's a mix of comedy as well as drama. And the comedy I had done all these years had been primarily political, social. I'd never done anything personal ever. It was just always joke, but never anything that was personal. And so I had no idea what, you know, I knew I wanted to do this. This was number one on the list. I want to write a show. I want it to be funny. I want it to be dramatic. But I have no idea what to write about. So a couple of weeks later, I have one of my comedy writing idols on, Carl Reiner, who's one of my guests on my Sunday morning program. And during the break, I said to Carl, I'm at this crossroads, you know, as a performer and a writer, and I want to write a play, but I don't know what to write about. And Carl said, you know, this happens to every performer at some point. Because with me, it was 1959. Sid Caesar's show just been canceled. I'd been with Sid since Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour 9 years, and suddenly it's canceled. Now what do I do? And somebody gave him a copy of Fred Allen, another one of my comedy writing heroes, Fred Allen, the radio comedian, who's Fred Allen's the one who said that television is called a medium because nothing is ever well done. And my absolute favorite Fred Allen line is, a celebrity is someone who works all his life to be famous so he can wear dark glasses and hope not to be recognized. Anyway, Fred Allen had written this book called Treadmill to Oblivion about network radio in the 40s and just how ridiculous it was. And in the introduction, he talks about how, you know, when you're writing a memoir or when you're writing anything, you have to find the piece of ground that you alone stand on, that nobody else in the world does, and you write from there. And his was network radio. So Carl starts to think, well, what's my piece of ground? Okay, I'm a married comedy writer. I live in New Rochelle with my wife and my kids, and I write for a comedy show in New York. And that became a program you may have heard of called the Dick Van Dyke Show. So what he said to me was, son, you've got to find your piece of ground. And I said, I don't know what is unique about me. What's my piece of ground? Then, as is, you know, fortune would have it, within a couple of weeks, I got that anonymous letter that starts off the book that says, "As an African American, I am disgusted every time I hear your voice because you are not a genuine black man." And I thought, bingo, no more calls, we have a winner.
Aren't people sweet?
Oh, well, you know, anonymous letters, you know. The anonymous letters you get in radio are just, you know, I have a guy in Southern California, San Bernardino is the postmark. He's been sending me anonymous letters for 10 years. And I call them ransom notes because it's like all the letters are cut out of magazines and pasted together. I'm serious. You suck. I hate you. And they're all like pasted together. And it's like, you know, I'm looking for the Zodiac symbol someplace on it.
And that's because he knows you'd spend a lot of time trying to figure out who he is.
Exactly.
Day
that's
and
exactly
night.
It. Yeah. The guy's got a lot of time on his hand, quite a bit. So I started to think about, okay, why is it, you know, I've heard this before, more from African-American people, but from white people, too, who will say, well, it's not like you're really black, or you're black, but you're not one of those. But, well, you know, why do people say that? So I went through this whole litany that ended up in the plane in the book about, okay, is it because of how I dress, you know, how I talk, because I TiVo Frasier, you know? You know, what is it? You know, when I hear the word axe, I think of it as a noun.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
You know, it's not a verb.
Yeah.
I'm going to go axe my mother. Like, what are you, Lizzie Borden? Get out of here. So I go through this whole litany, and I realize, okay, it's because culturally I spent from the age of 8 onward, or at least my formative years, as the only black face in the room when, in 1972, my family moved from Hayward, California, to San Leandro, which was on the border of Oakland. And at the time, Oakland was half black, according to the 1970 census, but San Leandro was 99.99% white. Now, I didn't know the statistics at the time. Yeah. I just knew that we had had some issues and just what it felt like to be different and to always be the one who was the outsider. So once I knew what my piece of ground was, I would walk my kids to school every morning, and then I would sit at this little cafe by my house called Sabino's with marble composition notebooks and number 2 natural wood pencils. And I wrote down every story I could think about what it was like to grow up being the only one.
Right.
You know, and there were a lot of things that were funny. There were a lot of things that were sad. There were a lot of things that I had forgotten about. And I realized later that I had forgotten about them because they were just so painful.
Right.
I couldn't, I deliberately repressed them. So this process went on for maybe about 9 or 10 months or a year. And by the time I was done, I had, I think, maybe a dozen marble composition notebooks, you know, filled front and back pages just with stories. So I thought, okay, I've got enough raw material, so why don't I go to the library and just for the heck of it, you know, look through the microfilm and just kind of see what was going on in town at the time to put it in some kind of context. So I go to the library, head librarian Cindy Simmons, who's just an absolute doll, who herself has just written a book on the history of San Leandro. And I told Cindy, I'm thinking about writing this play on what it was like to grow up in San Leandro when there were not many black people here. And she says, "I have something you need to see." So she takes me in the back room and opens up a file cabinet, and there's a yellowing stack of typewritten papers. And what it turned out was it was a term paper that was written by a San Leandro resident by the name of Don Magnifico for a sociology class at what was then Cal State Hayward University, and is now Cal State East Bay. And it was called "How San Leandro's 10 Homeowners Associations Keep the City an All-White Ghetto." And it was written in 1967. And I said, "What?" And I look at this thing, and he has interviewed contemporary residents. There had been hearings by the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. I had no idea about this. There had been a documentary that had aired nationally called The Suburban Wall. I had heard rumors that there had been some TV thing years ago, but, you know, I was anecdotal. I didn't know anything in particular about it. But there were all of these things that were informational things about the city that I had no idea about. And so I said, can I borrow this? She says, sure. And I tracked down Don Magnifico, who still lived in town, and I said, I'm writing this play. I found your term paper, and I wonder, can I use it as a source material? Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, God, that was 35 years ago. I forgot about it. Here, knock yourself out. So I used that. That was ground zero. Based upon that, I went back and interviewed as many sources as I could find that he interviewed, and everybody I talked to led me to somebody else who had a story.
Wow.
Or who told me about something that was going on. Right. or pointed me in the direction of articles. There were articles written, you know, San Francisco Magazine had written an article called The White Noose about all of the places in the East Bay that were less than 0.01% white, and most of it was done by design. And that was the thing that I found out in my research was that, you know, San Leandro had been around since 1872, but when it really became the suburb it became was right after World War II, when you had a lot of African Americans who moved into Oakland, so you had a white flight from Oakland, and as well as blockbusting, which was going on. Well, a realtor were coming to, and this blows my mind that this went on. It's actually, you know, it's brilliant in how sinister it was.
Right.
But the process was is that you'd have a realtor go into a white neighborhood and offer a homeowner maybe twice what his house was worth. Then, after he bought the house, he'd sell it to the first black family he could find at a loss. And then, within a month, every house on the street would be up for sale.
Yeah.
And he would scoop them all up and sell them to black families. And there was a white flight situation. And one of the places where people fled was San Leandro, which had this scheme of these homeowners associations that have been described in other publications as being like pseudo corporations, where they could arbitrarily decide who was and who was not a fit homeowner to live in a particular area. And it worked for a number of years. It worked for 30 years.
Well, I thought those quotes leading into the chapters were just stunning sometimes. And It blew my mind, too. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, so I'm somewhat familiar with the process. But I was wondering, you know, you write about it, that here in the Bay Area, we celebrate diversity.
Right.
We feel like we all get along, and it's a great place with many different ethnicities and people. And yet, this history of San Leandro, why do you think it's not more prominent in the history of the Bay Area, really?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it was, you know, it was kind of the town's dirty little secret. And there were people, you know, there were basically the people that lived in town at the time that are still there. I put into three categories. There were those that were complicit in the de facto segregation.
Mm-hmm.
There were those that were completely oblivious, that really didn't have any idea that it was going on, either children or people who, you know, were not the targets of harassment or these things, so how would they know? So there were the complicit, the oblivious, and my personal favorites, those who were complicit yet claim to have been oblivious.
Ah, okay, yeah.
And there have been a few of those folks who I found who come up to me after the show and said, oh, you know, I was a realtor in town at the time, and I did everything I could, and it was just terrible how bad things were. And then 6 months later, you know, somebody sends me a clipping from the era, and there he is defending the policy. But it was collusion. It was collusion between the homeowners associations, who controlled the city council, and enforced by the police department.
Right.
And at the Oakland-San Leandro border at Durant Street in East 14th, that was known as the Invisible Wall, was what they called it. And if you were black, you knew not to cross over that line. Because once you did, there was a cop who'd sit right there, and he would tail you until either he found a pretext to stop you or you turned around and went back across the border. Even little kids on bikes, you know, guys my age now who are like 8, 9, 10 years old, time tell me stories about this, you know. But you talk about Chicago, and the thing that, well, there are two issues here. The first is what makes this a story is that it is the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. If this were about Mississippi, people would go, and?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If I said this took place in Alabama, people would say, and your point is what?
Right.
But here, you know, this story takes place, you know, 20 miles from San Francisco, 10 miles from the UC Berkeley campus, 5 years after the Summer of Love, and you've got this racist little enclave going on. And what I have since found out doing the show around the country is this went on in every major metropolitan area in the country. Mm-hmm. What happened was, as the Civil Rights Act passed, you could not legally discriminate in housing anymore. So there was a white flight from the suburbs. The busing was going on and things. There was a white flight from the cities to the suburbs. And once white folks got to the suburbs, they were there because they didn't want to be near people who were not like right. them. And they did whatever they could to keep them out. But this went on everywhere.
But you know what's, you know, one of the things that's so important about the book is, of course, I don't want to be oblivious. You know, I'm a newspaper man. I have my fingers on the pulse. But, and, you know, it doesn't surprise me that black men are stopped by the police for no reason at times or things like that. But the book, I found especially when you're telling the story of when you were a little boy. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. And it comes around to this idea that there are, as you wrote, there are some things very hard to experience if you haven't been through it. And these
exactly.
things,
yeah.
they explode onto the national scene, you know, if it's Rodney King or O.J. Simpson or even the shooting in Oakland at the BART station.
And there's
recently.
A big furor for, you know, for a few weeks or a few months, and then it goes away.
And how people react to it, obviously, has a lot to do with who they are and how they grew up.
And how they perceive the world is
exactly.
part of it. You know, what's interesting, the two biggest audiences I've had for the play, and the play's now in its fifth year.
It's
and
amazing.
I've done 530 performances
oh
so far.
You must do it in your sleep.
Yeah, just about. I could,
not when you're on
I
stage,
guess.
I mean, but when you're sleeping, you must also be doing
it. I can, actually.
That's what I mean.
the interesting thing after doing so many shows is to find out that that my biggest audience is teachers and educators
uh-huh.
and therapists, psychiatrists, and people who work in mental health. And I asked one, I said, why do so many therapists come to the show? And what I was told is that most of the problems that adults deal with are rooted in issues from childhood.
Right.
Most therapists are white. So when they deal with clients of color, they can empathize, but they can't really get it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do in the play and in the book is I take you by the hand and let you see the world through the eyes of an 8-year-old little African-American boy who has no safe haven at all, who's harassed right. walking down the street by police authorities, who's harassed by nuns, who's harassed by, you know, who has no safe haven at home because of an abusive father,
right.
It really gives them a lot of insight.
But there was the point where you wrote about, you know, you think of it maybe as like having served in Vietnam, like how
right.
do you, so, I mean, is there any hope for races to understand each other? How do we get past the fact that I will never have lived your life in San Leandro and you'll never have lived my slightly whitey flight life from the suburb nearest Chicago to a suburb a little farther out? What is there hope for us to communicate and to understand each other?
Well, the president of the United States will be a black man in 2 weeks.
We'll be getting to that.
You know, who knew?
But
that was a surprising night. You know, I'll tell you what was a surprising night, because I, you know, had said publicly I did not think that he could win
mm-hmm.
because of the Bradley effect and other things. I did not think that he could win. And I'll tell you what surprised me and what I finally thought, oh, my God, he may actually do it. And it was election night, and it was really neat. Election day was really, really neat because my oldest boy, Adam, it was mm-hmm. his first, my three children are biracial,
uh-huh.
and it was Adam's first election. And my daughter is 17, and she worked the polls.
Wow.
And my youngest is 13, and he came with us, and I'd been taking them to the polls since they were busy, in strollers, because I wanted them to know it was important to vote. And so we get there, and my daughter signs us in, and I think, oh, my God, we get to do something now that people in America have, white people in America have taken for granted
yeah.
for 200 years, and that is we have an opportunity to vote for someone who looks like us. So that was a real emotional moment. So, but I still at that point didn't think that he could, I thought it was more symbolic, I didn't think he was going to win. So here's what turned me around. I'm driving after I dropped the kids off to pick up dinner. And a buddy of mine calls, one of my radio colleagues calls, and he asked me if I saw the story in the AP from the previous Friday, and I had not seen. I don't know how this got off my radar. But somebody was in Alabama, like in real rural Alabama, and they were canvassing on Friday and knocking on doors and saying, you know, do you know who you're going to vote for on Tuesday? So the guy knocks on this door, and this, you know, this redneck woman answers the door, and he says, hi, you know, we're taking a poll, want to know, do you know who you're going to vote for on Tuesday? And she yells back in the house, hey, honey, who are we voting for? And a southern man's voice yells out, tell them we're going to vote for the N-word.
Okay, that's progress, huh?
And I thought, oh, my God, they even lost the racists. They alienated the racists. It's that bad that the, you know, Klansmen are going, okay, before I put on my hood, I've got to vote for Obama first. And then, honey, finish ironing the robes. Well, yeah, I'll be done as soon as I check it for. But that's when I thought, oh, my God, he can win.
Well, those pictures from Chicago, watching television in Grant Park of African Americans, tears streaming down their faces.
Oh, I burst into tears. I was just, you know, I was just, you know, I was surprised by how emotional I was. I burst into tears, and Adam asked me, he goes, Dad, why are you crying? And I said, oh, my God, I just realized for the first time anything is now possible in America. Hmm. Anything can now happen in America.
It's amazing. I saw those pictures and I thought, well, you know, it went a lot better than the last time a bunch of Democrats gathered in Grant Park, but
much better.
But beyond that, it was.
But
really,
the whole world was still watching.
Yeah, and it was incredibly moving, and it was one of those moments where I thought, I can't have that exact experience. I was actually a little choked up myself. But I was not a black man standing in Grant Park waiting for a black president-elect of the United States to come and speak to me.
I'll tell you a funny story. And that is right after it was 8:01 Pacific Standard Time that they officially declared him the president-elect. And within 5 minutes, my phone was ringing off the hook, my cell phone, the landline, Adam's cell phone, all these text messages, every white person we knew saying, congratulations! Good job, you guys! And it's like, well, I checked the box, what do you congratulate me for? Congratulations!
I actually, as I said at the beginning, I'm very white, and I felt somewhat self-conscious about black friends saying to them, hey, isn't this great? You know, that's like saying, isn't this great for you?
Well, see, that's kind of how it comes across, because what people are going to have to understand in the mindset is going to have to be that he is not the president of black people.
Yeah.
He is the president of the United States of America. I've given a couple of interviews. I've given a couple of interviews to a couple of periodicals where people, and it's just funny, here's the premise of the stories. There have been three I've done. And the premise of the stories have been, what are comedians going to do now that there's a black president?
Right, right.
And I just think that's the stupidest question I've ever heard in my life.
I'm glad I didn't get to that one.
So, yes. So am I. Because, I mean, what my political comedy and most good political comics, you know, what it's based upon, it's based upon policy and whatever it is he gives us. You know, race shouldn't matter in any way, shape, or form. It's based upon what he does after he puts his hand on the Bible and he begins to govern. You know, that's where the jokes will be, not because, you know, of the color of his skin. So it's like, you know, oh, what are you guys going to do? Are you going to hold back? And what can white comedians make jokes about him? Well, if he has, you know, makes policy this, if he chokes on a pretzel watching a football game, you know, yeah, we're going after that, you know.
Well, that was what I was wondering, is aren't comedians going to miss George Bush?
Like I miss hemorrhoids.
Yeah.
My favorite joke of all time. George Bush is running down the street. He's jogging. And he comes upon a little boy. A little boy's got a box with him. And he says, "What you got there in the box, son?" Little boy says, "They're kittens." Bush says, "Well, what kind of kittens are they?" Little boy says, "They're Republican kittens." He says, "Oh, that's the cutest thing in the world." Next week, he's out. He's jogging again. He's jogging with Bill Frist. And same little boy's there, same box. He goes, "Bill, you got to see this. This is the greatest thing in the world." He says, "Son, tell Senator Frist what you got there." Little boy says, "They're kittens." He goes, "Tell him what kind of kittens they are." Little boy says, "They're Democrat kittens." He goes, "Wait a minute. Last week, you said they were Republican kittens." Little boy says, "Well, yeah, but now their eyes are open." It's my favorite joke.
Now, you know, you write in the book, we were talking about it a little bit before, but that, you know, San Leandro has changed a great deal.
San Leandro is now the fourth most neighborhood diverse city in the state of California.
Wow.
As of the 2000 census.
Well, you talked about that some of the racism is dying as the racists died.
Oh, yeah. It's a great quote that a friend of mine is a business owner in town whose name I don't use because I know he'll get some, you know, some flack for it.
Yeah.
But he said that the racial attitudes in that town have changed coffin by coffin.
Yeah.
That's the quote. Coffin by coffin.
Then, I mean, do you have hope that as generations go on that racism will fade? Or do kids, you know, pick it up? They obviously pick up a lot. Do they pick up racism from their parents, the media?
Well, see, here's what it is. You know, my son really kind of put it best. After Proposition 8 passed here in the state of California, denying the rights of gay people to enter into what is really a contract. You know,
right.
Marriage is a contract. If your religion or religious beliefs don't subscribe to that, then, you know, that's fine. That deals with your church. It has nothing to do with signing a legal contract. And some of the most homophobic people I met in my life have been black people. Some of the most anti-Semitic people I met in my life have been black people. I mean, intelligent, educated, professional black people will start popping off about how the Jews control the media or about gays this or gays that. It's just shocking. And what Adam said to me was that he compared it to high school. He said it's the freshman sophomore syndrome. And what the deal is that when you're a freshman in high school, you're just taking crap.
Yeah.
And mainly you're taking crap from the sophomores because they took it last year. Now we're better than you because we're sophomores.
Yeah.
And then when the freshmen become sophomores, they'll do it to the next group that comes in. So it's kind of the newcomer syndrome. You know, every group for some reason has to feel that there is at least somebody they're ahead of. I mean, the Irish were treated horribly in this country when the Irish came here en masse in the 19th century. And again, some of the most racist people that I've met in my life have been Irish folks. And you think, why in the world would you be this way when you should understand, you know, when there were signs that said no dogs and no Irish, you know, in places. Actual signs up front, no dogs, no Irish. You should get it.
Yeah, it's... So optimistic or no?
I think that as human beings, we continue to evolve. And I hope that evolution continues.
Uh-huh.
That's really the best way I can put it. But again, you know, we're talking an awful lot about race, and I really want to make it clear that the book and the play, while, you know, the title Black is in the word black is in the title, and I talk about, you know, the racist experiences I had in that town. It's really more about being different.
Right.
Because, I mean, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, we were the first Asians in, you know, our community in the suburbs of Wisconsin. We were the first Jews in, you know, the suburbs of Michigan when I was growing up. You know, it's just all about what it's like to be different. Because at some point in your life, you are going to be the only one.
Right.
Whether you're the only black, the only white, the only man, the only woman, the only whatever, there is some point where you will find yourself in a situation where you were the only one. And so the question then becomes, how do you survive when you're the only one? And especially, you know, me being 8 years old, being a little boy, I grew up thinking something was wrong with me because I wasn't like the other kids.
Yeah.
I grew up thinking that there was something wrong with me.
That was just heartbreaking, some of those experiences, and I could feel that trembling, crying child. And it's that's very, very moving, those passages.
Thank you. Well, I decided when I started to write the original stories in my notebooks, that in order to do this right, I would have to be naked. I don't mean I took my clothes off in the cafe.
Okay, all right, fine.
I would have to. I couldn't hold anything back. So I wrote with the frame of mind that, well, nobody will ever see this necessarily. Maybe these pages will never see the light of day. And that way I could be freer, which is why I could write about my depression.
Right.
Which is something that I'm glad to see that more and more people prominent people are coming forward talking about depression. Because, again, that's America's dirty little secret.
Yeah.
You know, so many people suffer from it. And once I, wrote in the book and when I was aging talked about my suicide attempt, I was amazed how many people I knew who, professional people I thought, same thing, you look at, you think their lives are together and are perfect, who said, I suffer from the same thing. I've had suicide attempts, or I've been on medication for years. And, thank you for talking about it.
Right.
Because you think, you walk around thinking you've got a great big scarlet D. That you wear on your chest. Mm.
Well, there were so many parts of the book that the foreshadowing was so strong, where your dad on your birthday coming to buy the car. I was like, no. I couldn't even, I just knew what was coming. But the suicide attempt, I didn't see that one coming. And I thought that was incredibly courageous to include. And I think from what you're saying now, I can see why there was just no way to tell the story and give yourself a break and just leave that part out.
Well, I'll tell you, I had qualms about it up to, and even through the performances of the show. The show opened in San Francisco in April of 2004. And, this was originally, the reason I say this was a fluke is this was supposed to be a 6-week run.
Wow.
It was supposed to be 6 weeks, and then I'd be done, and I'd be the next thing on my someday list. That was it, and I'd be done with it. And the first night, there were 7 people. The next night, I think there were 20. The next night, there were 40. And then reviews came out, and you couldn't get into the place for the next 2.5 years.
That's amazing.
But even after reviews came out, and the critics were very, very kind, I still had some qualms about it. I mean, I have to, the two most difficult things that I have to do on that stage every performance, I have to beat my mother, and I have to go there.
Yeah.
I mean, and I really have to go there, because if I don't go there and feel it, then it's not real for the audience. And the other is I've got to sit in that car, in that garage, with the top down and the motor running at my lowest moment, and really feel what it is that I felt at that time. And I'll tell you what took away the qualms from me. And that was maybe about 2 months into the show. It was a Saturday night. Usually after the show, I'll come out and shake hands with the folks and, thank them for coming and meet people. And this woman in her mid-30s, dressed in a business suit, it looked like maybe she just got done working at her law firm and, came in to see the show.
Yeah.
Came up to me, and I thought she was either going to, tell me a story about where she grew up. I hear a lot of these kinds of things. And what she says to me is, I think about killing myself every single day. And I've never told a living soul because I'm afraid if I do, they'll lock me up. Mm. But I figured if you can go on stage and talk to strangers about it, on Monday, I can go and get some help.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I went, whoa. And I said, okay. And then it was the right decision to put that in, because it has actually helped some people. And I've since gotten letters and things from people who've told me that it's given them the courage to either go forward and seek treatment, or at least to not feel ashamed about it, because it's a disease.
Yeah.
It's a disease. I still fight it. I still battle it.
Yeah. Do you think you were depressed as a little kid?
No question about it. I didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
I used to call them, when I was a kid, I used to call them my blue periods, like I'm Picasso or something.
Yeah.
And, where I would, you know, would sit in my room by myself and just not eat or, you know, not feel like doing anything. And, you know, and in hindsight, that's it. You know, where you feel like there's this hole inside of you that you can't fill it no matter what you do. You can't fill it with, you know, as a child, I couldn't fill it with playing or with eating or with watching TV or whatever. As an adult, when it's there, I can't fill it with, you know, relationships or, again, or food or liquor or entertainment or anything else. It's just when that hole's there, it's there.
Wow. And how would you perform? How would you be funny or even be on TV? When you're dealing with this depression, particularly the comedy, that just seems so counter.
I laughed so I didn't cry.
Yeah,
that was a lot of it. And you'll find if you look at the lives of most great comedians, and not that I put myself in that category at all, but I mean, if you look at, you know, like the life of a Chaplin, for example, I mean, you find out that a lot of these guys, most of them, you know, Lenny Bruce had just these horrible, horrific childhoods, and that was their means of survival. You know, comedy was their refuge. That was their, you know, the way that they were able to get by. They didn't know that they were going to do it professionally. You know, probably the only comic I've ever even heard of who supposedly, I mean, who knows what we'll find out in a tell-all book in 20 years.
Right.
But supposedly was really well-adjusted as a kid and had a fine upbringing was Jay Leno. That's the only one that I've ever heard of.
Well, he's not that funny. Well,
he's got a show 5 days a week. I don't.
Yeah, me neither. But we'll be here through the weekend. Don't forget to tip your bartenders. But I often, you've written a book, I haven't, and I often blame my parents for that because they did give me a very secure life. And, but it's obvious from reading your book that you certainly had a lot of material. And
Well, the great thing about the book was that once the play took off, all of these people, as I said, I would come after the show and I'd shake hands with folks and talk to people. And all these people who had lived in the area at the time would come up to me and tell me stories. And there were all these stories, that, again, that I hadn't heard or hadn't found in my other research. And then coincidentally, with maybe a week or two after the reviews came out, I got a call from an old friend who was a literary agent who said, would you like to write a book? I think this would make a great book. And that was number two on my Sunday list, was to write a book.
Wow.
Coincidentally. And I said, yeah, I'd love to. And she goes, I think it'd be a great story. And I thought, well, gosh, I have all these other stories. You know, there were people I knew who I had no idea were at the forefront of the fight for equal housing at that time.
Right.
And there were 50 people in San Leandro who were willing to put their names publicly as being part of fair housing. And they got death threats and bomb threats and bricks thrown through their windows. And this one woman, Mimi Wilson, God bless her, who I'd worked with for years, on this sweet little old lady who I'd worked with for years doing charity work at our local community center. After the play came out, she gives me this box of documents from 1970 to 72. She was the president of Fair Housing. And it's all these minutes and all these documents about how they would go and do testing, where they would send a white person into a real estate office and they'd be shown, you know, the multiple listings and whatnot. Then maybe the next day they'd send a black person in and they'd be told, oh, that's a mistake. I should have been in there. And some were real ridiculous. Some, you know, there was one story where, you know, the black person comes and the door is closed suddenly and the shades pulled down and the clothes, I mean, literally. I mean, but just the stories that came out, and so writing the book enabled me to take a lot of those stories that I got and to incorporate them.
Well, I thought you did a wonderful job weaving the historical reporting you did with the really heartbreaking stuff and then some of the funny stuff. It didn't come out like some Frankenstein monster, you know, where you're talking about this a little bit and then something over here.
Well, you know what I did is when I was a kid growing up, I loved the Norman Lear shows of the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
And it amazes me now with the subject matter, because a lot of the subject matter today couldn't get on the air.
Right.
And we'd sit down as a family and watch All in the Family and watch Maude and watch, you know, these shows. And it's like, you know, I learned about menopause from watching Maude. I know what a menopause is.
It's better that way.
You know. And you can't tell jokes, see? But it was, it was like, you know, All in the Family would be really funny, and then Edith got raped. Remember that?
Yeah,
Edith got raped. And so what I did when I was actually crafting the raw material into the play, I found a wonderful director by the name of David Ford in San Francisco, who, as I would say, if it weren't for David Ford, the play would have been 2 hours of really good intentions. And what I did was I knew I wanted that roller coaster ride, that rhythm. Mm-hmm. So I watched the first two seasons of All in the Family, just back to back to back to back to back, to see how they would do it. And Norman Lear was brilliant. It was just, it was hysterical 1 minute, and then all of a sudden it would take this left turn after you're laughing hysterically and you're kicked in the gut. And so basically that's what I'm doing in this book. And one of the coolest things is when I did the show in Los Angeles the first time, Norman Lear came to the show.
Wow.
And he said, "I really liked what you did." And I said, "Well, I got to tell you, I stole it from you. I'm doing you." And he said, "Well, you got me down perfectly."
Oh, that's great. No wonder he
liked
it.
So that was very flattering.
Now, tell me about, you had some very strong women in your life.
Yes.
And your mother, I can see the tension in the book about your thoughts about her and then maybe some later thoughts after reflecting on it. But this idea that she moved you to this white town, and she seemed to want to fit in sometimes, and then she was tremendously courageous to put up with this lawsuit, put up with that landlord. And I heard that you had somewhat recently, found her diary, and I'm wondering whether that, what you learned about her from that.
Well, actually, it was a number of years ago. I found one of her journals that she wrote during the trial.
Oh, wow!
And it was enlightening to find out how her emotions were a combination of fear for what was going to happen and disgust at the fact that she had to be in this place. I mean, her entire, my mother liked to put on airs. My mother was what black folks call siddity. Yeah. She liked to put on airs. I mean, she was born in Birmingham and grew up in Akron and told people she was born in Providence, Rhode Island, because it sounds better than saying, "I'm from Birmingham, I'm from Providence."
I've been
there. She never set foot in Rhode Island in her life. and so she was always, trying to, assimilate and find the next, get us up to the next rung on the ladder. Whereas grandma was just straight, strong, tough, no nonsense, no airs. If I would say to grandma, this probably describes grandma better than anything else. And this is my next book. Incidentally, I'm halfway through.
Is that right?
Yes, I'm halfway through writing a book. I'm hoping for as a Mother's Day book for next year.
Wow.
About grandma, called "To Grandma with Love," and it's an ode to single mothers, because she was a single mother twice with my mom, and then after my mom passed away with us. And probably this sums up grandma better than anything else. If I would come up to grandma and say, "Oh, grandma, look at this picture that they took at school. This is a terrible picture of me." And grandma would say, "Well, the camera can just take what's in front of it."
Yeah.
That was grandma. Yeah. No nonsense, honey, the lighting might have been bad, or maybe the photographer didn't focus. Well, the camera can't take nothing but what's in front of it.
Well, she is a bizarro version of my Uncle Louie, but that's a whole nother story. But she was also quite important in you seeking help for depression and beating it, I assume. Can you talk about that?
I won't say that I beat it. Because I haven't beaten it. It's a disease, and it's a recurring, disease. I'll have bouts, I'll have bouts today when I if I can just get out of bed, if I can just today get out of bed, it'll be okay.
Right.
It happens, and that's just the way, unfortunately, that it is. But she was very tough and very strong and very, very, very no-nonsense. I mean, she wasn't a huggy, touchy, feely kind of a woman, but she was, the mama bear.
Yeah.
And if you touched her cubs, what she did was one thing else, but nobody else ever better lay a finger on you. And, you know, hardest thing in my life is, you know, if you have read the book or have not read the book, you don't know this yet, but she, we lost her in July of 07, suddenly.
Yeah,
she had a stroke. Clear blue sky, and that was very, very difficult. That was very, very hard.
I'm sure that was.
But, yeah, very strong, very, very strong woman.
You know, the other thing, I had almost forgotten about Judge Ware and about his telling the story of holding his dying brother when that isn't exactly what happened. And I'm sure he's pleased that you've brought it up again, but...
sure he is.
I'm kidding. You know, the Mercury had some pretty good coverage of that, too. You mentioned the Chronicle, but... but anyway...
What's the Chronicle?
As a young man, you really looked up to him, and I was quite impressed when you met him.
He was the first African American male I had seen who was a professional.
Yeah,
and that's the one thing that I hope comes across in the book, that the story that I relate is not meant to disparage him in any way, shape, or form. You know, I can truly say I wouldn't be where I am today were it not for him in having met him and realizing, wow, you know, someday I can put on a suit and I can put on a tie and I can work in an office and I can have people who will respect me and will treat me as an equal. The purpose of me including that story in the book and in the play is twofold. That's the first part, to talk about the impact, and I to this day consider him to be one of my heroes.
Right.
To this day.
Right.
The second part is because of the fact that the story that he told really illustrates a lot about what the book is about, because I know that this man, and again, I haven't talked to him since I was 10 years old. But now, thinking back, I know that he got that same nonsense about not really being black or trying to act white because he went to Stanford or whatever. And so, you know, I haven't discussed it with him. As I said, I haven't seen him in years. But my assumption is that he, you know, felt that he had to have some kind of a quote-unquote authentic black experience, you know, in order to say, yes, I am a black man, the same as you, so don't tell me I'm not really black.
Right. Right. Well, you know, we talked about President-elect Obama earlier, and he came under criticism for not being a genuine black man, in fact. It seems to have simmered down, as far as I can tell. But.
Well, yes and no. And you know, the whole point here is, you know, this goes on in every culture, is the thing I found out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was part of an author's luncheon with Mike Wallace a couple of years ago. And, you know, he said that he gets, every time he would do a 60 Minutes report on Israel, where he would take Israel to the woodshed if he felt that, you know, if there was something that Israel did that was maybe not the best thing, then he'd get all these letters from people saying, you're not really a Jew, because no Jew would ever criticize Israel, or you're a self-hating Jew. You know, Asians who are considered too Eurocentric, their peers will say that they're trying to act white and they're bananas, yellow on the outside, white on the inside.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Twinkies, you know, that's how I think. Latinos, the same kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So this goes on in every culture, and the fact of the matter is that nobody has the right to define you but you.
Right.
I mean, that's the point. If you want to boil it down, and I just saved you $14, that's the point.
Go see the play.
Is that nobody has the right to define you but you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it brings to mind this whole construct of the black community or the Asian community. You know, what does the Asian community think? Well, it's a pretty big community, you know.
I've always thought that was preposterous when you watch these talking head shows. And I'm here with a black perspective. Wait, nobody called me. Al Sharpton's not speaking for me. Why are they talking to him about my perspective?
Yeah.
It's kind of a ridiculous assumption to make.
Yeah. Well, you know, the media often work with a meat cleaver, not a scalpel so much, but... So we have an interactive part of our program where we have solicited questions from the audience. And the first one I'd like to read is, if you could ask President-elect Obama any question other than a political question, What would it be, and why?
I think the question I would ask him is, what was it like to grow up with an absent father and a white mother?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard enough to grow up with an absent father, but to grow up with a white mother and white grandparents must have been doubly hard.
Yeah.
So that would probably be the first thing I would want to know. And how, you know, how did he cope? How did he survive?
Yeah.
And, you know, remember, I guess, in up through high school, he wasn't Barack Obama. He was Barry.
That's right, yeah.
You know, he went by Barry.
Maybe we'll get him here sometime and ask him. What motivated you to stay in San Leandro and raise your family there?
Two things. One was that my mother fought too damn hard for us to be there mm-hmm. in the first place, and she was not there to stand her ground, so I stood it for her. And the other thing is because the city has changed, and it's such a wonderful place to live.
Yeah.
It's just such, it's changed so much. It is so diverse. We have wonderful restaurants. I mean, I should get a job with the Chamber of Commerce after this, actually. But it's really a wonderful community, and it's a wonderful place to live. I'll tell you a great story. You know, my daughter Carolyn, when she was in the eighth grade, a boy in her class, who she'd gone, you know, my kids in parochial school, like me, you know, I suffered. Why shouldn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And this boy she'd been in school with since kindergarten calls her the N-word. And I called my sister Tracy, who lives up in Sacramento now, and I said I was really upset, and I said, Carolyn got called the N-word today. And Tracy said, well, how old is Carolyn? I said, she's 14. And she said, and this is the first time she's been called the N-word. And I said, yeah. And she said, in San Leandro. And I said, yeah. She said, wow, things really are better. True story, because that seems like the first day. I mean, I would walk to school. We'd walk to school, and adults would drive by and yell the N-word out the car window at us.
I was curious about this myself. So this person is wondering why the subtitle of the book changed. I think it was or How I Claim My Piece of Ground in the Lily White Suburbs.
Well, here's the deal. And that is, you know, this is my first foray into publishing. And it is a business that I am still trying to figure out. And I'm very fortunate that I've had a great mentor, and I'll tell you that story in a minute.
All right.
But what the rule is that with a nonfiction book, you have to have a subtitle. And I don't understand what the reason, the purpose
either.
Is. Mm-hmm. And there was this whole big argument, you know, among the, you know, the staff, all the chefs around the pot about what the subtitle should be in the hardcover, what they agreed on, and I reluctantly went along with, because out of everything else, that was the best subtitle.
Okay, yeah.
Was How I Found a Piece of Ground in the Lily White Suburbs. And I didn't like it. I thought it was off-putting. I thought that, you know, there would be white folks who would look at it and think the book was something that it's not.
Uh-huh.
And I went with a different publisher for the paperback and was able to change the subtitle, and they allowed me to go with the one that I wanted, which is really what the book is about, which is about being an outsider.
Yeah. Well, it's good to have a book with a title that says what it's about.
Yeah, and that helps time to time.
Yeah. Now, what about your mentor?
Oh, I'll tell you a great story. I love crime fiction, and originally, you know, my number two was to write a book, and I thought my first book would be a crime fiction book, because I read a lot of crime fiction, and my favorite author of crime fiction is Jonathan Kellerman.
Okay.
You read Jonathan Kellerman, any of you folks? It's Alex Delaware books. They're wonderful. He's written, I don't know how many, 30 or 40 of them.
Lots, yeah.
And what I did was, is I got hooked on his books, his audiobooks, read by an actor by the name of John Rubenstein, who works on Broadway, and I used to watch as a kid on the show Family when I was a kid. And what was wonderful was that this was the first time I'd ever heard an audiobook where the reader did different voices for each of the characters.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I learned how to do the characters and the voices for the play, was listening to Kellerman.
Huh.
So after I had the book contract from, you know, periodically they want to see a certain number of pages. So what I would do when I had a deadline coming up, you know, I wrote 1,000 words a day, and it was my quota, and then I would send it in and say, okay, we need to see 50 pages or 75 pages or whatever by a certain day. And I would price line a hotel, and I would go, you know, price line a hotel someplace and lock myself into the hotel room and look for reasons not to write.
Yeah.
Literally, you know, it's what you do. You procrastinate. You look for reasons not to write. But I knew that I would not leave. I'd check out on Monday. I would check out on Friday. And I knew that I'd have my pages done. So one day, while I'm procrastinating, my big procrastination, you know, was to watch judge shows. I watched Judge Judy and all this. That's all. As soon as this Texas justice is over, then I'll write something. So I'm sitting at the computer, and I thought, gee, I wonder if Jonathan Kellerman has a website. It just popped into my head. So I Google searched, and yes, he did, and they had a contact me link, and I contacted, hi, you know, Mr. Kellerman, you know, I'm a big fan of your books, and here's what it is I do, and I have this play, and I learned how to do the voices from listening to your books, and you're my favorite, and I'm a writer, and you're a writer. Let's be friends.
That was before Facebook, huh?
Yeah. And he writes me back within an hour.
Wow.
Within an hour, he writes me back, and we start this back and forth correspondence. And he, you know, really, you know, motivated me. Yes, you can get this done. Yes, you can do it. Stick to your quota. Here's, you know, don't worry about this. Don't worry about that. Yes, you can do it. I mean, because this guy's constant. Wow. He's had two books out this year already. And they're all number one New York Times bestseller. And his wife, Faye, you know, Faye Kellerman, is also a New York Times bestselling author. And so what the coolest thing was, well, two things. He blurbed the book. You know, if you look at the back of the book, he was kind enough to read the galleys and give me a quote. But when I opened in Los Angeles, I walk out the first night, and I'd never met him in person. I walk out the first night, and they're in the front row, or John and Faye Kellerman sitting in the front row. And they invited me over to their home in Beverly Hills. The next day I came by, and we're sitting in the kitchen, and we're having drinks, and Faye is making snacks. I'm thinking, oh, my God, Faye Kellerman's making me snacks. This is the weirdest. This is, like, surreal.
Now, this is a couple that would have you over, and I think they'd be off, like, writing in between talking.
Yeah, well, he does. Never he does 5 or 6 pages a day, and he does it every single day, and so does she, and that's why they're as prolific as they are.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, before we finish up, I wanted to ask you, I was going to ask you what's next, but obviously you're in the middle of a book, so that sounds very exciting. Mm-hmm. And the play is still
going. The play continues to go. The play opens in San Francisco on Friday, and it's going to run probably for a couple of months. I'm taking it back to the Marsh for the 5th anniversary. I'm going to do a weekend here in San Jose the Tabard Theater. On San Pedro on the 19th through the 22nd, I'm going to do 4 performances.
Okay.
We are Rob Reiner's been trying to help me develop this thing as a series. We've been having script troubles forever, but I think we're close. And,
really?
Yes, and Courtney Conti, who was the head of Carsey Warner Entertainment at the time when they were doing The Cosby Show and Third Rock from the Sun and Roseanne, has just attached to be the executive producer. So, so we're getting close.
So you're easing up, huh? Just starting to relax a little.
Yeah, that's it. I'm waiting to exhale. Well, hey, there's a title. I can use that.
Hey, I like that. Well, I'm sure glad you had time to spend with us, and I'd like to thank you for that, and I'd like to thank all these fine people who showed up. It's been a really nice evening. So thanks.
Well, it's been an honor. Thank you very much. Do we stay or do we go?
Well, I'd like you to stay for just a moment. I'm Melinda Cervantes. I'm one of the co-chairs of Silicon Valley Reads. And I'd certainly like to thank Brian and Mike for letting us sit in on this great conversation that you just had. And I think it's worth another applause. Round of applause.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.